Emily Watson, Cheryl Campbell, James Frayne, and Bernard Hill. Light ripples across the grey-blue surface of a river seen from underwater. The long, slim shadow of a rowing skiff passes overhead. Bubbles gather round the pointed prow as it smoothly skims out of view, then cuts across again at a different angle. Joanna David, Nicholas Gex, Sheena Govan, Peter Gunn, Will Knightley, Ivan Meredith, Paul Ridley, Jessica Turner, James Webber Brown, and Lucy Wybrow in a screenplay by Hugh Stoddart, based on the novel by George Eliot, The Mill on the Floss. Produced by Brian Eastman, directed by Graham Theakston. The broader shadow of a rowing boat darkens the surface. Seen from above, a girl lies curled up in the boat, sleeping as it drifts aimlessly on.
I'm sorry.
The girl, Maggie, sits up. Ranged along the bank like waxworks are the people in her life. A young lad, a top-hatted gentleman, a woman in a blue silk gown. A young woman, her cousin Lucy, staring coldly, is rowed past. Asleep again, Maggie, in the boat, drifts on. A red brick watermill straddles the River Floss. Inside, a young boy is sweeping up. An older lad, Luke, picks up a wrench and opens the sluice. Outside, the heavy iron mill wheel slowly starts to turn. Light plays across its wet, slatted surface. As it picks up speed, a shower of drops spill from one slat to the next. The water in the mill race is churned to a froth. Inside, the white-flowered cogs of mill machinery whir and spin. A trotting white horse pulls a cart along the lane beside the mill pond. At the reins, Edward Tulliver. Beside him sits a young boy, his son Tom. The cart passes over the bridge by the sluice gate and heads towards the mill house. In the dusty corncroft amongst the sacks, a little girl sits reading.
Hey, your brother's here, Miss Maggie.
Luke grabs a sack. Maggie's face lights up. She puts her book down beside an old worn doll and scampers headlong for the door. Luke grins. Flinging the door open, Maggie hurries outside, her long brown hair swinging behind her. She runs to Tom, flinging her arms about him.
Oh, Tom, Mother said I couldn't come to fetch you.
Hush, Maggie.
Tom pulls back. Their father comes up, giving Tom one bag to carry, Maggie another.
Come on, either way.
Tulliver follows his children as the lad sees to the horse. In the stable, the lad opens a cage and takes out a stiff, dead rabbit. Tom stares solemnly as the lad holds it out to him. Suddenly, Tom shoves the lad roughly, then turns and runs outside. Maggie is feeding a gaggle of geese. Tom yells from the bridge.
You didn't see to it!
Maggie puts down her bowl. Her lip trembles.
My rabbit's dead and it's your fault!
I'm sorry.
I don't love you, Maggie.
Tom!
Maggie chases after him.
Tom!
He brushes her off and strides quickly away. Maggie turns back. Her face crumples. In the corncroft, she slams her doll against a post.
He's so cruel! I forgive him if he forgot anything!
She pounds the doll against a dusty sack.
I still love him!
Tom appears at the top of the stairs.
Maggie!
He walks across the bare boards in the shadowy croft.
Mother says you're to come and have your supper.
Maggie edges out of sight, hunched against the grain sacks, clutching her doll.
Maggie!
Tom comes closer. He's holding a small parcel. Maggie doesn't move. Tom spies her over the sacks, slowly approaches, and quietly sinks down close beside her. Maggie turns her face away.
I brought you some plum cake.
Slowly, Maggie looks solemnly up at Tom.
It will be good.
Then sadly nestles her head against his shoulder. Outside, men gather by the mill.
Right, come, Mr. Tulliver.
A top-hatted gentleman jumps down from a gig. Sunlight glints on the glazed, pantiled roof of the mill. Maggie and Tom watch the men from the far side of the mill pond. Taking Tom by the hand, Maggie leads him past a weeping willow. They sit down on the bank as the men arrive on the sluice bridge opposite. Some of the men peer over the wall and look down at the water. Others look out towards the lush green fields beyond. The gentleman removes his top hat and takes a book. A burly farmer stands behind him.
My client here has no wish to be unreasonable. He is a neighbour to Mr. Tulliver. He brings his grain to Dulcot Mill. But this latest increase to the height of the dam across the River Floss is causing my client grave inconvenience.
Edward Tulliver sits on the wall of the bridge as Wakeham points to the fields.
His lower meadow and the lane beside it are frequently waterlogged and impassable to my client's cattle. Now that cannot be supported by custom and practice.
Custom and practice does support it, Mr. Wakeham. Careful regulation of water flow is vital for the good working of a mill. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Tulliver is entitled to take
right,
whatever...
Quite right, Mr. Riley. I didn't raise my dam to cause anyone trouble. I'm merely safeguarding my mill, that's all.
Maggie.
It's an arbitration. Father will win. That man with the books and papers, he's the lawyer.
Mr. Riley speaks.
Both parties to this dispute agree to arbitration. And my decision as arbitrator, duly appointed, is final. I fine for Mr. Tulliver in this matter. The dam stays at its new height.
Tulliver slaps his thighs with glee.
Thank you, Mr. Riley.
I'm sorry. I did my utmost for you.
Wakeham shakes hands with his client and moves away.
Charge you the utmost, more like.
Tight-lipped, Wakeham turns back to Tulliver and glares at him coldly.
You think this is a circus, sir?
Then turns on his heel and stalks away. Tom and Maggie run up.
Tom!
Mr. Riley smiles.
Your father's been asking my advice as to your schooling, Master Tulliver. My advice is Parson Stelling.
Tom looks anxious.
Right, come away.
They step aside as Wakeham's gig approaches. Wakeham stares at them grimly as he goes past. Tulliver gives a wry smile.
These lawyers are all rascals. Sent by the devil to do his mischief on this earth. Take that man Wakeham now. Posturing and quoting from books. I saw what he was up to. Trying to make me look foolish. But you, Mr. Riley, bless you, you made Wakeham look foolish. Tom, I want you to grow up with a proper education.
But I just want to work in the mill like you.
No. The mill won't support you as well as me. No, you should go to a new school and be like Mr. Riley here. A surveyor, eh? Maybe, perhaps, who knows? An engineer. Make your own way in the world, eh?
Did that farmer want you to learn a dam again, Father?
And you, my little wench, you're far too clever for a woman. You're like a long-tailed sheep. You won't fetch a better price at market.
He strokes Maggie's hair. Indoors.
Keziah!
Mrs. Tulliver.
Keziah! Where's that girl?
The maid, Keziah, shrugs. Mrs. Tulliver bustles to the stairs.
Maggie!
Maggie's in her room, sitting dreamily.
Look at you! My sister's all arriving and you're not even dressed.
Maggie peers out of the window.
Folks will think it's a judgment on
it's
me,
Lucy.
Maggie, having such a daughter as you. They'll think I've done something wicked.
Still unkempt, Maggie runs outside.
Cousin Lucy.
Oh, Maggie, dear, how are you?
Fine, Aunt Sophie. We've seen some otters, baby ones.
Maggie leads Lucy off. Her mother comes out.
Oh, sister. Welcome. Oh, lovely to see you.
Good day, Lucy.
Excuse me.
She hurries over to Maggie and Lucy.
Look at you. Shame. Why can't you look like your cousin Lucy? Oh, neat and pretty with her fair curls.
She marches Maggie back.
And when you come down, I want you to get on with your patchwork bed cover for your aunt Glegg, like a little lady.
It's foolish. Tearing up pieces of cloth and then sewing them back together again.
Maggie stomps into the house. Mrs. Tulliver turns.
Sister.
She holds out her hands to the smartly dressed Sophie and leads her and her family indoors. In the main room, Sophie is sobbing.
She died but yesterday. Her legs as thick as my body.
Oh, Sister Sophie.
Bessie Tulliver gestures to Keziah, who goes to the door. The third sister, Jane, and her husband.
Thank you.
Jane hands the maid her bonnet. Sternly, she sweeps into the main room, her husband trailing behind her. She kisses Bessie politely on the cheek, then glares.
Sister Sophie, what's the matter?
It is a neighbour. She took ill and died.
A woman in the village, dropsy. Severe swelling of the legs, of course. Very bad business.
It's not someone to whom you were close. I don't believe, Sister Sophie, not family.
No, but it did upset me so there, but for the grace of God.
Come now.
Clapping her hands dismissively, Jane leads the way into the sitting room. Tom appears in the doorway.
Mr. Dean.
Tom, my boy.
Hello, Lucy. Hello, Uncle Dean.
Well?
Oh, come on, Sister Sophie.
Tom leads his cousin off.
I'm going into the floss later. You must come. I know where there are otters.
Maggie told me.
She doesn't know. We'll just go, the two of us. We won't tell Maggie. I'll take you to the river and I'll show you where the otters are.
Tom!
Maggie calls from the stairs.
Here!
She's mad.
Tom goes with Lucy. Jane sits frowning.
1:30, indeed. Mr. Tulliver does generally like it at 2, so I thought... Sister Bessie, Dodson's, have dinner at 1.
Maggie's in the doorway.
That girl's hair be better thinned. Shorter. Bad for her health to have it so long.
No, it's not in our family, is it, Sister Jane? Unkempt hair.
Maggie flees to her room. She clutches a large pair of scissors. Tom runs in.
Maggie!
Glancing at him, Maggie takes the scissors and starts to hack off her hair level with her jaw. Long tresses of unbrushed brown hair fall to the floor.
You catch it, you will. Do it!
Maggie thrusts the scissors at Tom and turns her back. Tom cuts the hair in a rough line around her collar. Maggie stares straight ahead, lips clamped firmly together. More hair drops on the pile beside her black-laced ankle boots. Tom starts to snigger. Maggie turns angrily, then stomps over to the table and sits in front of the mirror. Staring grimly, she fingers her bobbed hair.
Don't laugh at me, Tom!
Maggie jumps up, pushing Tom back. He turns on his heel and saunters out. Downstairs.
My friend, Mr. Riley, the valuer, did recommend Parson Stelling strongly. A good tutor. An Oxford man.
The guests are unsmiling.
I want Tom to be even with lawyers and such like.
Be better for some people if they let lawyers alone.
And what's that intended to mean?
I'd hold your tongue, Mr. Dean. I'm saying nothing, seeing as advice isn't called for.
Very rare sight indeed, Mrs. Glegg. You not giving of advice.
I don't know about giving. I've been over ready at lending, I'll admit to that.
You've had the interest on that loan you gave me. You can have your loan. I'll pay you back now, if you like.
Oh, sister, don't be so quarrelsome, or you'll have a fit and we'll all be in mourning again.
I wouldn't be here, being abused, if there weren't them in our family as married worse than they might have done.
Sister Jane!
My family are as good as you Dodsons. Better! For not having such a damned ill-tempered woman in it!
Well, I'm not staying any longer to be swore at.
Maggie appears.
Oh! You wicked girl! Oh! You'll break your mother's heart!
What little girl's this? We don't know her.
Mr. Glegg?
Jane pauses by Maggie.
Little girls who cut their hair should be whipped, fed on bread and water.
Then sweeps out. Her husband raises his eyebrows and trails in her wake. Bessie fingers Maggie's ragged hair. Pretty Lucy with her ringlets bites her lip. Tulliver reaches out and kisses the top of Maggie's head.
You were right to cut it off if it plagued you. Father will take your part.
By the banks of the Floss, a tumble-down cottage. Tulliver trots towards it on his white mare. A woman comes out.
Gritty, good day to you.
Brother, will you come in?
She has a child on her hip.
I've not the time. Thank you.
Tulliver ties up the horse and lets himself through the rough wooden gate. Removing his hat, he walks straight past his sister with barely a glance. She watches anxiously as he stops awkwardly a few yards away.
Sister, I've need of the £300 I lent you.
Oh. We've had another bad year, brother. I can't deny that.
Tulliver frowns and walks over to where a little boy is playing with a fish trap.
I said you'd come to grief marrying that man. Never had a penny, never will. I mortgaged my mill to pay for your dowry. And then I lent him £300.
Oh, we'll have to sell up. I don't know where else to find it.
Tulliver looks stern.
My wife's sisters demanded the £500 I borrowed from her.
Gritty's lip trembles.
And there's the expense of my son's education.
And how are your two, Edward?
Yeah, both well, thank you.
Oh, you must bring them. Maggie especially. Oh, she's such a loving child. And so quick and clever.
She takes after our family. None of her mother's in her.
Tulliver walks back towards the miserable cottage, then shaking his head sadly, turns to look at his sister, with her careworn face and shabby clothes.
Now, don't you fret, Gritty. I'll manage without that money for a little while longer.
Tulliver goes. Gritty sighs with relief. The white mare, drawing a cart, trots briskly up a leafy lane. Tulliver is at the reins. Beside him, Tom, dressed smartly in a dark brown jacket and a corduroy cap. The cart has stopped in the gravel drive of a fine brick house. Tulliver hands Tom his bag.
Is this a school?
Mr. Tulliver!
Mrs. Stelling will be your tutor.
Tom looks on glumly as Tulliver walks over to the beaming Oxford man. Dressed in clerical black, Stelling holds out his hand. Tulliver shakes it. Stelling's wife watches shyly from the front porch as Tulliver walks back across the neat patch of grass to where Tom is waiting.
Work hard, lad. Bye.
They shake hands.
The whole term.
We'll come and visit, eh?
Tulliver adjusts Tom's collar, then quickly turns away. He climbs up into the low-sided cart, takes up the reins, and drives off, keeping his eyes straight ahead. Tom stands forlorn as the cart disappears around the sweep of the gravel drive. Stelling calls to him.
Dear boy, come.
In the library, Stelling frowns over Tom's exercise book.
You haven't grasped even the basic principles.
My dear Thomas.
Onward, we shall fashion a scholar from you yet. Hypotenuse, thus, make a square from it, equals the square from this side and this side. Do you see?
Tom stares blankly.
Is the fog lifting?
At night in his bedroom, Tom kneels by his bed.
And dear God, bless and keep my mother and my father. And bless and keep my little sister Maggie. Make her visit soon. And make Mr. Stelling say I needn't do geometry anymore. Amen.
Daylight. A cart draws up by the mill. Inside, the cogs and gears of the mill machinery are turning. Outside, a farmer stands in his cart and attaches a sack of grain to a rope. The sack is hauled up the side of the mill and taken in through a hatch in the overhanging gantry. The great slatted mill wheel turns, churning up the millstream. Maggie is sitting in the long grass, reading. Hearing voices, she gets up and looks across the banks of the Floss. In the fields opposite, the top-hatted Wakeham is talking to another man holding architect's plans.
See?
Tulliver comes up.
I was totally gone to lawyer Wakeham. This man Pivot has bought all the fields from the copse of trees there Right over to the lane there. All upriver of us.
Tulliver's talking to Luke.
He's setting on an irrigation scheme that's going to draw water from the Floss. We'll have the mill pond dropping a level.
He's a rich man, Mr. Tulliver. Rich men do get their way as often as not.
I want none of that feeble talk, Luke. Dorlcote Mill was here first.
Angrily, Tulliver strides off. Maggie frowns thoughtfully. The white mare pulls Tulliver's cart up the leafy drive to Stelling's house. Maggie is seated beside her father. For once, her hair is neatly brushed and tied back with a ribbon. She is clean and tidy. She looks at her father as the cart pulls up outside the ivy-clad brick porch. The substantial house has turrets and castellated walls. Tom peers through the window excitedly.
Oh, Tom!
Maggie runs into the library and hugs him.
Well, you look well, my lad. Your new school obviously suits you.
I don't think I am well, Father. Will you ask Mr. Stelling not to make me do geometry?
What? What's that?
I'll help you, Tom.
Mr. Tulliver! Good day.
Good day.
Stelling comes in.
Ask him if I can stay.
The wench would like to know if she can stay for a few days. A week, perhaps.
My dear, you shall stay 2 weeks. Mrs. Stelling and I shall have a houseful. I have a second pupil starting next week. Mr. Wakeham's son, Philip.
Tulliver looks at Tom.
Have you now?
Tulliver goes out to the cart. Putting on his hat, he climbs up onto the driver's bench. Tom follows him out and waits awkwardly by the traces.
I don't mind leaving here, you know, Father.
He looks up sharply.
What?
But you don't mean to study with Mr. Wakeham's son, do you?
The lad's a poor, deformed creature. And there's little of his father in him, I hear. It's a sign Stelling's a good teacher. Wakeham knows meal from bran.
He holds out his hand. Tom shakes it.
Good, here.
Tom watches sadly as his father drives away. A smart, closed carriage comes up the drive. The coachman halts the gleaming chestnut horse, then jumps down to open the carriage door. A young, pallid boy with curly black hair and wide, staring eyes clambers out and looks around him. He has a hunched and twisted stance. Tom watches furtively from the window. In the library, the boy sits at the table sketching. Tom walks slowly round him and peers over his shoulder. Unconcerned, Philip carries on, intent on his work.
That's good.
You have to look. Look and draw.
Wakeham, do you love your father?
Yes, of course. Don't you love yours?
They look up as the door opens.
This is my sister Maggie. She's just visiting. She's not a scholar here.
Maggie comes over and shakes Philip's hand.
I'm being sent to a girls' school after Christmas.
Maggie sits at the table and opens a book. Philip goes back to his drawing. He looks across at Maggie and gets up again. Tom watches jealously as Philip hands Maggie a large leather-bound book.
This book is full of magical stories.
Latin stories?
And Greek.
I wish Mr. Stelling would let us go fishing. Have you ever been fishing?
Fishing's boring. This story is about Ulysses, his travels, and all the hardships he endures.
Quick! March!
Outside.
About Anne!
Tom is being drilled.
About Anne!
By an old soldier.
About Anne! About turn and halt!
Maggie's watching.
Relax the shoulders, Master Tulliver. But don't droop.
Is that the sword you used in battles, Mr. Poulter? Could I see it?
A very dangerous weapon, my lad. An edge is what you could shave with.
He lunges playfully at Tom. In the library, Philip's practicing his violin.
Wakeham, come and watch Mr. Poulter.
I'm not interested in sword drill.
But you should try.
Go away, you lumbering idiot.
Philip limps up to Tom, who sneers.
You know I won't hit you, because you're no better than a girl. And I'm an honest man's son. Your father's a rogue, everyone says so.
Philip stands motionless. In Tom's bedroom.
I like Philip.
Maggie is lying in her bed. Tom sits up in his.
He said he loves his father.
He couldn't choose his father. Bad men can have good sons.
Dismissively, Tom leans across and blows out the candle. Maggie sinks back on her pillow.
Mr. Wakem makes father so cross. He talks about Mr. Pivert and irrigation and lawyers and courts all the time. It makes mother cross.
But father will win.
I think women are much crosser than men. Mother tells me of much more than father does.
You'll be a woman one day.
I should be a clever woman.
Then you'll be a big head and everyone will hate you.
You won't hate me, will you?
Tom looks coldly at her, closes his eyes and pulls the cover over his head. In the darkness, Maggie sighs and lies down. Daylight. Grey cloud hangs heavy over Stelling's house. In the library, Maggie bends studiously over her books. She smiles across at Philip, who's practicing his violin. Philip stares solemnly at the music with his heavy-lidded eyes. He has a gaunt, narrow face, pointed chin and freckles. He clamps the violin against his hunched left shoulder.
Can you sing, Philip?
Yes.
Sing a song then, would you?
Philip steps away from the music stand. Maggie clears her books and turns her chair to face Philip. She sits down and prepares to listen. Philip opens another music book on the stand and looks shyly across at her.
I can concentrate better like this.
Maggie lifts her pinafore and covers her face.
My ship is rigged and ready, and I must be sailing. When shall I return, love? I just do not know. I shall cross oceans, be guided by the stars' light. And the best star of all is the light in your window.
Slowly, Maggie lets the pinafore slip and a smile spreads across her face. Philip is sketching her.
If you had a brother who was like me, would you still have loved him as much as you do Tom?
Better. Well, not better. I couldn't love anyone more than I love Tom, but as much. I should be so sorry for you.
He looks down at his work.
You're so clever. I wish you were my brother.
You'll go away, and you'll forget all about me.
I shan't forget you.
And I'll never forget you. Whenever I'm very unhappy, I shall think about you. I like your eyes very much.
Do you?
They seem to be trying to speak. Kindly.
I think you're fonder of me than Tom is. Would you like me to kiss you, the way I do Tom?
Yes, very much. Nobody kisses me.
Maggie slowly rises, steps across, and solemnly kneels beside Philip. Gently, she kisses his cheek.
I shall remember you always. And when we meet again, I shall kiss you again.
Philip smiles, gazing intently at Maggie. A carriage drives along a street past a fine townhouse. On the railings, a brass plaque reads J. Wakem, Esquire, Solicitors and Commissioners for Oaths. In the study, Wakem pours a drink.
Tell me, Philip, how are you finding Parson Stelling?
Tolliver takes a lion's share of his energies.
Dimwit, is he?
He has no desire to learn. His father is wasting his money.
Wakeham hands the boy a glass and they sit formally in leather armchairs facing the fire. The room is dark and shadowy. Philip looks keenly at his father.
How's the fight?
Pivart has to irrigate that land or it'll be worthless to him. Tulliver thinks his mill is sacred. And he's wrong. Water mills are being replaced by steam. And the sensible owners know they can't always carry the day anymore. Tulliver won't compromise. He's a fool. And in the end, he'll see he's a fool.
People say that Wakeham means me no harm. Oh, I know that.
In the mill.
But he's one of these fine gentlemen that gets money out of doing business with poorer folk.
He studies plans.
And when he's made beggars of them, he'll give them charity.
Bessie brings a tray of drinks. Tulliver rolls up the plans.
But I know what's right.
There.
And if that means going to court, then so be it.
Maggie, Tom and Lucy listen.
But we've a long way to go.
Lucy, dear, I need to take.
You have as little to do with that son of his as you can, Tom. If he lives long enough to inherit his father's ill-gotten gains, there'll be a curse on him.
Tulliver takes Tom aside. Maggie cranes her neck, watching as they leave the room. Outside, the mill wheel turns. The mill stream gushes through a narrow channel and spills into the Floss, the ripples spreading as the river meanders through the lush green countryside. Tom and Maggie are sitting together on the low branch of a leafy tree.
When you finish with school, and we're all grown up, I shall keep your house, and we shall be together, always.
Solemnly, Maggie leans forward and kisses Tom gently on the cheek. Tom looks at her and gives a small smile. He reaches out and takes her hand. Then he jumps down from the branch, turns, and reaching up, puts his hand round Maggie's waist and helps her to the ground. Hand in hand, they run across the rough green grass towards the mill. The scene fades to black. 7 years later, Maggie, now grown up, is sitting at the piano. Her long brown hair straggles down to her waist. She wears a plain grey woolen gown with white collar and cuffs. Her hands move over the yellowing keys. In the mill, a youth appears at the door. Tulliver finishes weighing flour, walks across and takes a letter from the lad's outstretched hand. Tulliver watches. The lad strolls over to Keziah, who's beating a carpet, and slips his hand round her shoulders. Tulliver turns away and opens the letter. He holds it at a distance, blinking, then up towards the light coming in at the stable door. Frowning, he screws the letter into a ball. Keziah looks round, curious, as Tulliver suddenly starts to sway. He clutches at the door for support. Keziah runs into the house.
Miss Maggie?
Maggie looks up.
Come quickly.
Surprised, Maggie starts to follow. Tulliver staggers outside.
Whoa!
A driver halts his cart and looks round.
Mr. Tulliver?
Father!
Tulliver collapses on the ground.
Edward!
Maggie and her mother run to him. They crouch on the ground beside his motionless body, staring at each other with frightened faces. It's early morning. Maggie waits on the bridge by the calm mill pond. A white horse canters up the lane. Maggie has her thick brown cloak around her. On the horse is Tom, now a young man, with wavy fair hair swept back off his forehead and long sideburns. He climbs down from the horse and Maggie runs to him. She flings her arms around him and hugs him close.
Oh, Tom!
In the main room, the relatives have gathered.
There's my maiden name woven so prettily. Elizabeth Dodson.
Bessie strokes her linen.
And now they'll all be sold and gone into strange people's houses and cut up and wore out even before I'm dead.
Mother, when you talk so, as if you cared only for things with your name on and not for Father's.
Bessie, never mind your linen.
Jane frowns.
Your husband lies upstairs, helpless, with not a penny to call his own. Well, everything's lost, that's clear. He's borrowed and borrowed. Now this court judgment has finished him. And there's his lawyer to pay. Pivart's lawyer. And the damages too, that is so.
Mr. Dean.
It is, Mrs. Dean.
Yeah. Well, he's right. You feel what disgrace he's brought on our family, and be humble.
You always said it would end in grief, marrying Mr. Tulliver. He's brought me to this. Don't speak badly of Father.
Hush, Maggie.
Tom swallows.
Aunt Glegg, since you think it's such a disgrace if everything be sold up, why not prevent it? You could advance the money you and Aunt Dean are planning to leave Maggie and me and pay what's owing.
That's all very well and good, Tom, but what about the interest that your aunts enjoy on the money while it's invested? Have you thought of that?
I'd work and pay that. I'd work at anything to save Mother having to part with her things.
Good lad. Well spoken.
Jane glares.
Well spoken, is it? That's my money you seem so ready to dispose of, left to me by my father. I've saved it and added to it year by year.
Well, I suppose I could buy some of Bessie's china, though I don't care for the pattern very much.
Why do you come here then? Just talking and interfering and scolding if you don't mean to help us. Father's better than any of you. He'd have helped you if you'd been in trouble.
Hush, Maggie.
Don't hush me. He's lent money to Aunt Gritty and never pressed for it.
Oh, my sweet child, I feel torn in two.
How dare you all blame him and damn him like this? Tom and I don't want your money. We'll do without you.
Maggie runs out of the room. Upstairs, Maggie opens the door of her father's bedroom. The room is sparsely furnished. Cold, clear sunlight filters in through the small framed window. Maggie tiptoes over to the bed where her father lies with his eyes closed. She kneels beside him and gazes earnestly at him. His eyes flicker.
Is that my little wench?
She takes his hand and presses it to her lips. Tom stands in the doorway. Maggie looks round. Tom steps in and stands by the foot of the bed, his eyes sad and solemn. Maggie comes up to him and rests her head against his.
I believe that scoundrel Wickham has been planning all along to ruin my father.
Tom, I'm sure that's not so.
Mind you never speak to Philip again.
Tom turns and strides out of the room. Maggie's face falls. She looks round uncertainly. Tom is walking down a busy street. A man is unloading a wagon. Tom climbs a flight of stone steps and goes in through a door. Above the door, the sign reads Guest & Co. Tom waits in an outer office. Mr. Dean emerges. With him is an elegantly dressed young man who glances at Tom, then whispers to Dean.
Tolliver's boy. Sad business.
Good day.
The gentleman shakes hands with Mr. Dean and goes out. Tom looks round at his uncle.
Tom.
He shoulders his leather satchel and follows Mr. Dean into the office, waiting hesitantly on the threshold, his eyes cast down. His uncle sits at a large mahogany desk.
I suppose you understand accounts, huh? Step up, step up.
Tom comes a few steps into the room.
I write well, Uncle. I have a sample.
Tom produces papers from his bag and passes them across the desk. Mr. Dean glances at them, then looks at Tom and nods towards a chair.
I told you, Father, I wasn't in favour of it, schooling with that Parson Stelling. No fine for the likes of young Stephen Guest. You saw me with him just now. That's his father up there. Mr. Guest of Guest and Company.
Points to a portrait.
You see, Uncle, I do want to enter some business, even if it's at the bottom, but where I can get on.
You've been educated to be soft-handed, my lad. You should do something appropriate, use your Latin or whatnot.
I need to pay the debts, and I shall. If there's a vacancy, sir, anything, I'll take it. In the warehouse, on the wharf. I want to learn about trading, Uncle. I want to work hard.
At the mill.
What shall we start the bids at, gentlemen? I start at £2. Anyone give me £2? £2 for you, sir. £2 and 10 shillings. £2 and 10 shillings. £3. Anyone give me £3?
The Tullivers are setting out their possessions.
£3 and 10 shillings.
So to the gentleman. Maggie snatches up the family Bible.
Item 15. This very pretty,
she hugs it to her as the auction continues.
Rocking chair.
A carriage drives past Mr. Wakeham's townhouse. Bessie is in the panelled study.
I hope, sir, you're not thinking I bear you any ill will because of my husband's lawsuit and the bailiffs being put in and
my linen sold.
Why have you come to see me, Mrs. Tulliver?
Wakeham stands.
If you please, sir. I'm not defending my husband for being so hot about the irrigation. And as for his fieriness and lawing, and now with him struck down as if with death.
What does all this mean?
What I mean is, what I came to say is, I can't believe but you behave like a gentleman and not by the mill.
Wakeham stiffens and narrows his eyes.
Who told you I meant to buy it?
Mr. Dean. He says as Guest and Company could buy it and let my husband manage it. But that's only if you didn't bid for it and raise the price.
But what if I bought it and let your husband manage it?
Oh, he could never be got to do it, sir. Your name's like poison to him. And as he looks at it, you've been the ruin of...
He's a pig-headed fool!
Bessie winces and looks down. Wakeham stalks over to the door and holds it open.
Please excuse me, I have business to attend to.
Bessie closes her eyes wearily as if to gather her strength, then rises and, clutching her cloak about her, moves slowly to the door. Wakeham stares fixedly straight ahead. Bessie raises her face to his.
They do say as when Dorlcote Mill changes hands, the river's angry, and it's bad luck.
Yes. Yes.
Wakeham walks back to his desk, leaving her in the doorway.
Please don't let on I've been to speak to you. My son will be very angry with me for demeaning myself, and I've trouble enough without being scolded by my own children.
Biting her lip, Bessie bobs a curtsy and goes. Wakeham, stony-faced, picks up his spectacles and fingers them thoughtfully. In an office...
Do I have any more bids for the property known as Dorlcote Mill? The house, the mill, and outbuildings, together with land as described in the particulars of sale. First time. Second. So to J. Wakeham, Esquire.
In front of the auctioneer, the title deeds of the mill, now the mill itself. The wheel has stopped turning. Inside, Tom helps his father down the stairs and through the stair door into the main room. Tulliver has a blanket round his shoulders. He moves stiffly like an old man. Bessie sits huddled by the fire. Tom helps Tulliver sit down at the table, then sits himself at the opposite end. Maggie brings an inkwell and hands her father the family Bible. He opens the cover. The front page is filled with handwritten script.
Elizabeth Dodson. 20 years since I was married.
Come next Lady Day.
Don't bear me any ill will, Bessie. We were promised for better or for worse.
I never thought it'd be so worse as this. Mother?
No. No, let us speak.
Well, I just... What I mean is... Wakeham's got everything. So what's the use of turning against him? He says you can stay here and have the managing of the mill and 30 shillings a week and a horse to ride to market.
She turns to Tulliver with pleading eyes. He sits grim-faced, looking at his family, then frowns.
I shall serve under John Wakeham. And I shall serve him like an honest man. But I shall never hold my head up anymore. I'm like a tree that's broke. And I'll never forgive him. Tom, write it in the Bible here.
Tom reaches for the inkwell and the book.
Father, it's wicked to curse and bear malice.
Right. That Edward Tulliver took service under John Wakeham to make amends to my wife.
Bessie turns away.
And because I want to die in the house where I was born and where my father was born. And put that I don't forgive John Wakeham.
and that I wish evil may befall him. Write that. And write that you shall always remember what John Wakeham has done to your father, and that you shall make him and his descendants feel it, should the occasion come.
Father, you mustn't do this.
Be quiet, Maggie. I shall write it.
Sign it.
Maggie stares out of her bedroom window. Her cousin is with her.
My father is so changed, Lucy. He's silent and bitter. He talks about blame and I hate it. My mother pines for her lost linen and crockery. Sometimes I feel so angry I hate them, Lucy. And then I cry for shame at turning my back on their sadness.
And how is Tom? I know my father has been pleased with him since he began work at Guest & Co.
Tom has little time for me. He hardly seems to mind anymore what I'm thinking or what I'm feeling. He just works and works. That's all he needs, Lucy. His task, his steady purpose. Whereas I...
Lucy takes her hand.
Dearest Maggie.
I want there to be great things. Beautiful things in my life.
She sees Lucy's sad smile.
It's a sin, isn't it?
And moves away.
To love myself. To seek my own happiness. Nothing ever endures, does it?
I want to be happy. I see nothing wrong in that. I want to love and be loved. Perhaps to be married, to have my children. These are joys which God has made for us, surely.
If we desired nothing, if we yearn for nothing, then we cannot be disappointed.
It's evening. Tom enters the main room. Maggie and Bessie are at the table, sewing. Tulliver's sitting by the fire. Tom hangs up his satchel and lifts a metal box off the mantelpiece. His father watches silently as Tom sits at the table, takes an opened envelope from his pocket, then unlocks the metal box. Bessie and Maggie smile quietly as Tom starts to count the money. Tom frowns.
There's more in here than there should be.
It's my contribution. I've been taking in plain sewing from the linen shop.
I don't like my sister to do such things. Don't lower yourself in that way. I'll pay the debts.
Let no one shout if she's a mine too. Every creditor must be paid, I know that.
Tom empties the coins from his envelope.
Father, do you think we might venture some of the money? Venture some to make much more?
How so?
We could do a little trading. I've looked into it most carefully.
No. There's luck involved in trading. And look sure to go against me.
Tom looks downcast. A carriage draws up outside Wakeham's house. The driver settles the horse. A young man gets out. It's Philip, smartly dressed in a tall black hat. He smiles at the servant.
Hello, baby.
Wakeham comes out to greet him.
Philip. How good to see you home. You've stayed in Italy too long.
They shake hands warmly. A gig bowls along the lane beside the Floss. It's pulled by a gleaming black horse. Philip sits hunched beside his father. From the mill, Maggie sees the gig and smiles nervously to herself. The gig crosses the bridge in front of the mill and draws to a halt. Philip cranes forward eagerly. Wakeham is tight-lipped. Tulliver is indoors looking at papers. Maggie hovers behind her father. Taking his time, he puts down his pen, closes his book, stands and puts on his jacket.
He wants every penny accounted for. Damn him!
Maggie waits uncertainly as Tulliver goes to the door.
Mr. Wakeham. Mr. Tulliver.
Wakeham steps into the narrow hallway. Philip follows awkwardly. Maggie slips quickly to the stairs. She pauses on the bottom step. Before Philip comes in, she starts to climb. He spies only the hem of her gown, disappearing around the bend of the stair. Philip stands hesitantly. A path covered in autumn leaves leads to a tumble-down building. Maggie stands outside, the wind ruffling her hair and her grey cotton gown. Behind her, Philip appears along the track. He slows when he sees Maggie, who turns and notices him. Philip limps slowly up to her, a warm smile spreading across his face.
You found me in my favourite place. We came here when we were children. We called it the Red Deeps.
You don't mind that I followed you here?
No. I wanted to talk to you, but, well, not at home. Not with our fathers there.
She smiles at him.
Oh!
Philip produces a leather frame, in it a picture of Maggie.
What a strange little girl I was. Am I how you expected me to be now?
Much more beautiful.
Maggie goes into the building. Philip follows.
Everything's changed. That's what I wanted to say to you, that I cannot meet with you.
Can't be right to sacrifice everything to other people's feelings.
I'll not make my father's life any harder for him.
I would give up a great deal for my father, but not a friendship or an attachment.
Tom has told me never to speak to you again. He doesn't change his mind.
What about me?
What about us both? If we begin to meet together, in the end we'll be found out, and parting will be more painful. I used to be so discontented because I couldn't have what I wanted. But I've given that up now. Wishing.
If we give up wishing, we cease to be alive. We must hunger after what we feel to be beautiful and good. I love fine paintings. I long to be able to paint them myself. There are other things I long for too, things which other men have, which will always be denied me.
I wish you didn't think so.
Then let me see you sometimes.
Maggie looks down, then gives a little smile.
I'll come here as often as I can, at about this time. So I hope to see you. There'll be chance meetings, won't they? You won't feel you've done wrong.
I remember saying all those years ago that you care for me more than Tom does.
Do you ever care for me more than you do for him?
The first thing I ever remember in my life is standing by the River Floss, holding Tom's hand.
At the mill, Tom sits at the table, studying his accounts. He looks up as Maggie hurries in. She stops short. Tom closes his book.
I'm pleased you seem to go out more. Fresh air puts colour in your face.
Maggie smiles, then heads to the stairs, keeping her face shyly averted. As she goes, Tom opens the accounts book again, turning to certain pages at the back. At the Red Deeps, Maggie sits by Philip in the old stable.
Dear Philip, you must have seen and learnt so much over all this time. I wasn't sure that you'd still care for me.
I knew you'd be the same as when we were children. These things which affect us the most, they do so in ways we can never fully explain. Why should one piece of music affect me so much more than any other?
Sing to me. And I shan't look.
Oh. Oh.
Philip stands, grinning shyly, and moves a few paces from her. Maggie covers her face with her hands.
My ship is rigged and ready, and I must be sailing.
Peeps through her fingers.
When shall I return, love? I just do not know. I shall cross oceans, be guided by the stars' light. But the best star of all
is the light in your window.
Philip smiles. Maggie lets her hand slide to her lap and grins. Philip watches her, but the sadness in his face.
I remember how much you love books, Maggie. I shall bring you heaps of them.
I've given up books.
Why? Why do you starve your mind in this way? You're stultifying yourself. You'll be thrown back into the world one day, and these simple satisfactions you deny yourself will assault you as if they were savage appetites. Don't deny yourself these things. Be that brilliant woman you are always destined to be. Full of fire and wit and imagination.
Maggie smiles ruefully. A cart rattles past the red brick exterior of Guest & Co. In the office, Mr. Dean listens to Tom.
Once I can buy my first goods and sell them, I shall be able to repay your initial stake. I can use the profit from each little transaction to buy goods for the next. I want to use the knowledge I've gained in working for you, sir. Use it well.
Mr. Dean considers and gestures for Tom to sit.
We must repay all the debts. My wages and my father's will never be enough. My father is ill with worry about it.
The mill wheel is turning. In the main room, Tulliver sits at the table, looking at receipts and entering amounts in different columns in a heavy ledger. In the mill itself, Luke removes a sack from the hoist. He's covered in flour and dust. About him, the cranks and cogwheels of the mill mechanism turn. Luke half carries, half drags the heavy sack past where Maggie is sitting thoughtfully. In the house, Tom is writing at the table. He looks out of the window and sees Maggie heading off along the path. Tom looks back to his letter, which begins, "Dear Captain." He carefully adds to the copperplate writing, dipping his pen in the ink each time. At the Red Deeps, Maggie enters the building. Philip follows.
I've often thought that you might love a man other women were not likely to love.
That would depend what they didn't like him for.
Suppose it was a man not conceited at all who had been marked out from childhood for a particular kind of suffering, who loved you. Whom you were the day star of his life. I was a fool, please forget I said that.
I've never thought of you as a lover. I mean, it's been just like a story that you dream of, that anyone should want to marry me.
Do you love me?
Surely it's best we don't speak of it, Philip. We can't even be friends except in secret.
Maggie moves a few paces away and sits down on a bench. She holds a little book in her hands and fingers it nervously.
Our meetings have been such a delight.
Philip smiles.
All our talks and the books. But they've made me restless again, and I grow weary of my home again, and that cuts me to the heart.
Philip sits by her.
Don't think about the past. Think about the future. Of our love. Every obstacle can be overcome in time. We need only wait. I can live on hope.
You promised me that when you saw me again, you'd kiss me. Kiss me now.
Maggie leans forward and kisses him softly on the cheek.
I don't want pity.
I don't think I could love anyone better than I love you.
It's brother and sister.
Oh, Philip.
Maggie kisses him on the lips. Tom is at the doorway, watching. Then steps in.
Wake him.
They spring apart. Philip stands.
How dare you trifle with my family's name and respectability?
Maggie puts her hand to her mouth.
Even friendship with my sister's out of the question. Neither your father nor her father would ever consent to marriage. You must see that.
So what do you think you're about then with your secret meetings?
Maggie is dearer to me than she is to you. You are incapable of understanding what I feel for her.
You come near her again and that puny, miserable body of yours shall not protect you.
You brainless oaf.
I'll thrash you, Wakeham, and hold you up to public laughter!
Stop it!
Tom glares at Philip, then snatches Maggie by the wrist. Roughly, he drags her out. Philip is left standing alone. Tom pulls Maggie along the path. She wrestles free, then starts to pummel her brother.
I despise you for sneering at his deformity. You've been finding fault with people all your life. You haven't got a mind large enough to see that anything can be better than your conduct and your petty aims. I know I've done wrong, but it's because I have feelings which you have never had, and you never will have!
You're so full of love and tenderness, and how do you show it? By disobeying and deceiving us.
Oh, you enjoy punishing me. You have no pity. No sense of your own sins. All you ever do is thank God for your own virtues.
I have a different way of showing my affections.
Oh, you're at the helm, aren't you? With your clever trading. Lucy's told me how impressed her father is, how grateful father will be for your achievements. But that is because you are a man and you have power in the world.
If you can do nothing, then submit to those who can.
I will submit to what I believe to be right, and don't suppose I will give up Philip just in obedience to you.
Either you'll swear on the Bible never to see him again, or I'll tell Father. You must choose.
Maggie strides off. Tom calls after her.
Choose!
Maggie runs up the stairs to her bedroom and slams the door behind her. She hurls her shawl onto the bed, strides to the corner of the room and hides her face against the wall. Turning, she leans back, her face crumpling, fists clenched, her eyes squeezed shut. She trembles. The mill wheel is churning the waters of the Floss. The mill house looms large above the river. In a meeting room, men gather around a long table. Mr. Dean is at one end of the table. Tom and Tulliver are with him.
Gentlemen, this meeting has been called for the benefit of those persons who regard themselves still as creditors against Mr. Edward Tulliver of Dorcott Mill. We welcome you all here today.
Mr. Dean sits, and Tulliver, frowning, gets to his feet. The men watch him expectantly.
It's a sad fact in this puzzling world that there are rascals in it. I name no one today, but there are those that seem able to take hold of a man's luck and break it into pieces. But I can tell you today that I have a son, Tom, here, who has taken hold of my luck and fair glued it back together again.
He rests his hand on Tom's shoulder.
I spent a deal on his education, and I consider it well spent.
Tulliver sits back down.
You've missed the important part, man.
Mr. Dean nods at Tom, who gets nervously to his feet.
I would just like to say that...
He's made £300.
What?
He borrowed a scrap from my brother-in-law, Mr. Dean, here. And with a lot of hard work, he made £300.
Oh, good boy.
And you'll all be paid.
Oh. Mr. Dean beckons to a maid who brings in a tray of drinks. Tulliver pats Tom's cheek and hugs the boy. It's dusk at the mill. Tulliver's on his white mare. He canters homewards along the path by the Floss, slowing to a trot as he nears the sluice gate bridge. Leaving the mill is another rider, Mr. Wakeham, trotting on his black horse. The two men draw nearer. Wakeham slows his horse and makes it stand.
Tulliver!
Tulliver comes slowly on.
I came to tell you I've had another complaint about the quality of your flour!
Wakeham wheels his horse around.
Then you can get somebody else to work in your mill for you.
You've been drinking, sir? Huh? At your little meeting?
I don't need drink to see that I should no longer work for a scoundrel like you.
Then don't! You can leave the mill tomorrow, sir. Now let me pass, damn you! You'll hear me first.
The two men spur their horses on, meeting on the bridge. The black horse rears. Wakeham is thrown. Tulliver jumps from his horse. Taking his crop, he starts to whip Wakeham before the lawyer can get to his feet. Tulliver brings the whip down again and again. Terrified, Wakeham crawls on his hands and knees but cannot escape. Maggie sees from the mill and runs towards them. Wakeham is groveling in the dust as Maggie pulls her father off. Luke helps haul Wakeham to his feet. The lawyer hangs limp in Luke's arms. Tulliver clutches at his chest and keels over. Maggie tries to support him. Bessie leads the way into the house. Maggie helps her father in. The iron teeth of the mill's heavy cogwheels slow and stop. A candle burns low by Tulliver's bedside. He's propped against the pillows.
I had my turn. I beat him. That was fair. I never wanted anything but was fair.
You forgive him? You forgive everyone now?
He turns to Maggie, who's sitting beside him.
No, my little witch. I don't forgive him.
He looks at Tom, who nods solemnly. Behind Tom, Bessie stands holding a candle. She's looking down at Tulliver, who closes his eyes. Maggie turns miserably from her brother to her father. Bessie sits on the bed, cradling Tulliver's head against her breast. He stirs slightly in his sleep, and she reaches out to take his hand. Gently, she rests her chin against his hair. The fire burns low in the grate. In the cold blue light of dawn, Bessie stands by the bedside looking down. Tulliver's eyes are closed, and slowly Bessie pulls the sheet up over his head. Standing back, she breathes deeply. Then, biting her lip, she turns away. She walks over to the door and, pausing on the threshold, her hand on the doorframe for support, Bessie looks back at the motionless figure shrouded in the bed. Steeling herself, she walks out of the room. Downstairs, Tom, half-dressed, barefoot on the flagstone floor, is standing stiffly, staring out of the window. Maggie approaches him, and he hugs her. Outside, a cart is piled high with the Tulliver's possessions. Luke is securing them with ropes. Tom comes up, reaches into his pocket, and hands the carter a coin.
Thank you, sir.
Bessie and Maggie come outside, dressed in cloaks and bonnets. They walk over to their own cart. Tom comes to help hand his mother up onto the bench seat at the front. Maggie sits in the back with more of their belongings. Tom shuts the tailgate, then walks round to the driver's seat and climbs up. Seated on a black horse watching the departure is Mr. Wakeham. Maggie keeps her eyes cast down. Tom picks up the reins and the carts move off. Luke stands with his head bowed as they pass by. Wakeham watches with no sign of emotion. Wakeham walks through the empty mill house, casting his eye around each bare room in a cold, businesslike way, a spectral figure in his black frock coat. Ducking to allow his top hat through the low doorways, he strides briskly out. A little way up the road, the carts have stopped.
I shall get it back.
Maggie and Tom stand looking back at the mill. Bessie sits in the cart, her eyes fixed on her lap. Tom rejoins her. After a moment, Maggie follows, climbing up onto the back of the cart. And they move off along the lane, leaving Dalkurd Mill behind them. The scene fades to black. 1 year later, An elegant wooden landing stage juts out into a gentle stream. Beyond the grassy bank, a sweep of parkland with a ploughed field and clumps of trees further off. A horse canters across at the edge of the field, framed against a dull grey sky. The rider slows by a fine brick house standing by itself. It has a Georgian facade. A stone balustrade divides the front garden from the parkland beyond. The rider is the elegantly dressed young man Tom saw in Mr. Dean's office. A servant holds the horse as he dismounts. From the window of the house, Bessie watches his arrival. At the front door, he hands his hat and coat to the maid. He is handsome, with straight brown hair parted in the centre and flopping to his jaw. He wears a tailored grey jacket with a velvet collar, white breeches and riding boots. He strides down the hall.
Good morning, Mrs. Tulliver.
Good morning, Mr. Guest.
I must say, you keep Mr. Dean's house very well.
Thank you, sir.
Bessie bobs a curtsy and hurries away. In the drawing room, Lucy is stitching her embroidery. She smiles as the door opens.
My love, I have some important news, Stephen.
She clasps his hands.
My cousin Maggie is coming to stay. And there is no girl in the world I love as much.
I hope she doesn't have the conversational abilities of her mother.
That's horrid of you, Mr. Guest. Poor Aunt Bessie. All during Mother's illness. And after she died. Bessie was such a comfort to me.
I'm told her brother won't tolerate being in the same room as my friend Philip Wakeham. Is Maggie Tulliver the same?
She's had a very dreary time since her father died and they had to leave the mill.
Oh, you had better warn Philip. He's such a sensitive soul. Only your delicate touch can lay his ruffled feathers.
He kisses her hand.
Both my father and your father think highly of Tom Tulliver. The rising star in Guest & Co.'s firmament.
Papa says he's very principled.
And proud as Lucifer, I suspect.
Stephen sits at the piano. Lucy places a hand on his shoulder. She's dressed in a pale blue silk gown. Outside, the house stands handsomely facing the river. Into its smartly furnished hall steps Maggie, wrapped in her old brown cloak. She hands this to the maid, then walks tentatively along the carpeted corridor. She wears a plain brown dress with a simple white collar. Coming up to her cousin, she kisses her on the cheek. Lucy gazes at her.
What witchery is in you that makes you look so fine in shabby clothes? I would vanish.
You enjoy other people's happiness so much. I wish I was like you.
You've had such a dull and weary life till now. And it's going to change. I shall see to it. You shall have new clothes and good music and delicious do-nothing days.
Maggie sits at the piano. Lucy stands watching her, smiling. Stephen arrives, and Lucy ushers him over to the piano. He stares at Maggie, transfixed. She looks up.
My cousin Maggie. Maggie? Stephen Guest.
Maggie rises and returns his stare. Lucy giggles.
I think Mr. Guest imagined you differently.
I wish I could always find reality so much more beautiful than my preconceptions.
So, now you've said what you had to say.
But my dear Maggie, you've always said you love to feel admired.
Too well, but being paid artful compliments has never made me feel like that.
I shall never pay you another, Miss Tulliver.
Thank you. It will be proof of your respect.
He gazes at Maggie. Lucy blinks.
Let's go on the river.
I'll fetch my cloak.
Maggie walks out of the room. Stephen gives her a sidelong glance as she passes. Lucy turns to him anxiously.
You will like Maggie, won't you?
Lucy hurries after her cousin, leaving Stephen troubled. The three walk down to the landing stage, Lucy in the lead. The wind pulls at the strings of her bonnet. Stephen and Maggie follow. On the little jetty, Stephen strides past Lucy and down a steep step. He takes both her hands and helps her down, then turns to Maggie to do likewise.
I should like to row. I'll need to be taught.
Lucy, you must sit in the stern and help our trim.
He puts an arm round Lucy's narrow waist and helps her take her place on the upholstered seat. Then Stephen turns and takes Maggie's hand.
I warn you, if I try something, I must do well at it or I don't do it at all.
He releases her. She steps into the boat. That night in Lucy's bedroom.
Tell me what you think of Stephen.
Lucy is brushing Maggie's hair.
Good and bad, too.
Oh, I think you should humiliate him a little. A lover should not be so at ease.
Nonsense. You think him conceited, I see that. But you don't dislike him, do you?
How could I dislike anyone who promised to make you happy?
Lucy smiles, brushes a few more strokes, then stops.
Philip Wakeham will be home again from his travels soon. We shall have good times together, the four of us. We shall sing and play music.
Oh, I can't. I promised Tom I wouldn't speak to Philip without his consent.
Tom cannot be such a tyrant.
I have such a dread of opening the subject with him and getting into a quarrel again.
Lucy kneels beside her.
It's beautiful you love Philip. I never thought such happiness would befall him. I shall contrive it. I shall make it possible. You shall marry Philip when I marry Stephen.
On the banks of the Floss.
Aunt Gritty.
Maggie calls at the cottage.
Maggie.
Her aunt's in the garden and they embrace.
Is Tom in?
Indoors, Tom's by the fire.
I want you to absolve me from my promise about Philip Wakeham. I wish to see him.
Glowering, Tom turns his back.
Not for myself, I wouldn't ask that. But for Lucy's sake, she knows him and she'd like him to come to her house.
Tom turns stiffly to face her, then tight-lipped lowers his gaze.
Very well. Is that all?
Oh, Tom, you're so hard on me. I've kept my promise all this time.
You're always in extremes. You've no self-command.
I see that even the idea of marriage would be wrong. I've given up thinking of him as a lover.
I see.
Tom brushes past her. He stands, frowning.
Well, I don't want to overstrain matters. I wish to be as good a brother to you as you will let me.
Maggie steps across and puts her arms about him. He holds her close.
You don't think me altogether wicked, then?
No.
Smiling, she rests her head on his shoulder. At the Dean's house, Stephen Guest strides up the path. He steps into the drawing room through the open French windows where Maggie sits sewing. He stops short. She rises.
Good day.
Stephen smiles warmly. Maggie turns away uncertainly and sits back down.
I was passing by. Lucy's out.
Maggie nods, then looks down at her work.
Would you tell her Philip Wakeham is back from abroad?
Stephen walks across to the piano.
And I bought the music she asked for.
He lays it down as Maggie tries to concentrate on her stitching. Purposefully, Stephen walks back towards Maggie, watching her working with her head down. From the open windows, the sunlight falls on the nape of her neck.
Do you like to sit on your own?
If that's not uncivil of me.
With your plain sewing?
A habit.
Life has been hard for you.
She continues her sewing.
Well, then, goodbye, Miss Tulliver.
She pauses, then stands quickly as he starts to go.
Oh, won't you stay? I didn't mean...
No. No, really. The boat's waiting for me.
She nods and looks down.
But you'll tell your cousin, then. About Philip.
Yes.
And the music.
Yes.
She looks awkwardly away. Stephen smiles, then turns to go. Maggie watches as he strides down the grassy path towards the river, his figure framed against the sunlight. Maggie runs upstairs into her bedroom, sits on the edge of the four-poster bed, and leans against the wooden post.
Oh, Philip. I wish we were together in the Red Deeps.
A gig, pulled by a glossy black horse, drives up the curving gravel path towards the Dean's house. At the reins is Philip. He slows, and a servant comes out to hold the horse's head. In the drawing room, Mr. Dean is playing cards with Maggie. Lucy opens the door and shows Philip in. Maggie gives the hint of a smile and rises from the table. Lucy whispers in her father's ear, and he stands.
I had an extremely good hand, dear.
And genially throws down his cards. He and Lucy leave the room, and Philip turns to Maggie, eyeing her nervously. She smiles and takes his hands. She leads him to a small couch and he sits facing her.
We can see each other, spend time together. While I'm here, I must look for more work soon. I will not live in a state of dependence, not on Lucy, nor on my brother, though he'd like me to.
Why seek a world away from those who love you?
I don't think much happiness can come to me from love. I've always had such pain mingled in it.
We cannot escape pain. Pain is part of life, as love is.
Philip, you're my conscience.
Has something happened? You look so well.
For a moment, Maggie's gaze falters. Philip is playing the violin. Accompanying him on the piano is Lucy. Philip looks debonair in a tailored dark grey jacket with a black velvet collar. He has a gold cravat around his neck and his curly black hair is parted in the centre. Lucy is delicate looking with a pale face and slim figure. Her fine fair hair is looped up at the back in a complicated arrangement of ringlets. She smiles at Philip, then stands to sort through her music.
Philip, I had the most interesting conversation with my father yesterday. He was asking about your father and whether he was losing interest in the mill. You see, Guest & Co. might be amenable to buying it.
And if they did, you'd persuade your father to hand it back to the Tullivers?
He does think so highly of Tom.
Really?
Would you raise it with your father? It would bring so much joy to Bessie. And to Maggie, of course. If Tom got the mill back because your father wanted to make amends, he might be more about Maggie and you.
In Wakeham's study.
Is this an unpleasant shock? Well, you're a grown man. You can marry her if you want.
I have nothing. Dabbler in art.
Ah. You need my money.
I need your blessing. I need to know it meets with your acceptance.
Oh, you ask too much, Philip. This woman's father was the bane of my life, and he nearly murdered me.
It had nothing to do with her.
She cares for you.
I believe so. As for me, she is everything.
He clasps Philip's shoulder.
I want you to be happy.
Thank you.
As happy as I once was. I know you hardly remember your mother. It's a great pity I didn't commission someone with your talents to make a portrait of her.
Father, there's another matter.
The mill. It's that damn mill again. Oh, let them have the wretched place. There. I'll sell it. But I'll have no direct dealings with young Tulliver. You can swallow him for the sake of his pretty sister if you like. But I've no sauce which will make him go down.
Wakeham turns and walks to the door.
Mm.
Philip sighs with relief, and looking at one of his pictures of Maggie, grins happily. It's evening. The Dean's house is all lit up. Along the stone balustrade, little nightlights flicker. They line the path up to the French windows. Framed in the yellow glow from each tall window are people gathered in the drawing room, the men in evening dress, the ladies in elegant ball gowns. Inside, Tom steps up to Mr. Dean.
Uncle, I must be going. I have to prepare for my journey to Newcastle tomorrow.
5 minutes more of your valuable time.
He smiles at Bessie.
Mrs. Tulliver.
Then sits beside her. In his hand is a folded document.
I have something very special for you.
He hands it to Bessie. She takes it, politely shaking her head, then starts to slip it from its cover. Lucy smiles happily at her. Stephen, Maggie and Tom stand watching. Bessie unfolds the document and her lip trembles.
The title deeds to Dorlcote Mill.
Bessie claps her hand to her mouth. Maggie kneels beside her as Tom takes the deeds and studies them. Philip and Mr. Wakeham appear at the door. Stephen goes to greet them. Lucy, beaming, kisses Tom on the cheek.
Tom, I did want to say that all this has been possible because Mr. Wakeham agreed to sell Dorlcote Mill.
Do not poison my joy, Lucy.
Mr. Wakeham wants to make amends.
Tom frowns and glances angrily across at the Wakehams and Stephen.
You've rehearsed this, I take it. I'm to be softened in this way. You expect to gain my approval to there being more between you and Philip Wakeham.
Maggie swallows.
Do you believe this restitution can remove the hurt of so many years? The hurt to father?
Tom hands the deeds back to Mr. Dean, puts down his glass and walks out of the room. Mr. Dean stands, bows to the ladies, then heads out after Tom. Philip goes into the hall. Maggie follows and finds him pacing.
I'm sorry.
How can your brother deserve such devotion?
He has become like this to overcome the harshness of our circumstances. Oh.
Philip limps a few paces away. Maggie goes to him.
There is a kind, gentle Tom. I fear you'll never see that side of him. I will do nothing which would divide me from Tom forever.
And that's the only reason that keeps us apart.
It's the only reason.
Maggie holds his gaze, then lets her eyes drop, turns and walks hurriedly away. She sits by herself in the quiet of the darkened landing. A figure climbs the stairs. She turns and sees Stephen. As he slowly approaches, Maggie stands, one hand against a slender pillar for support. He comes up behind her, and she moves a few paces away. Her chest heaves as he deliberately follows, standing behind her, gazing at her intently. Maggie stands very still. Stephen at her shoulder slowly lowers his head and places his lips against her bare neck. Maggie closes her eyes for a moment, then stiffens as he kisses her again.
How dare you? You insult me.
Of course, it doesn't matter what a man suffers. It's only your woman's dignity you care about. I'm mad with love for you, Maggie.
Please leave me.
Maggie stands stiffly and will not look at him. His dark eyes troubled, Stephen backs slowly away. When he's gone, Maggie trembles. She stands outside in the garden, her shawl wrapped around her. Lucy comes out of the house.
Maggie?
Maggie clutches at her shawl.
Maggie?
Lucy comes up to her.
There are ways around these barriers. Between you and Philip. Come into the house.
Presently.
It's cold.
She takes Maggie's arm.
And I have a plan. You must come and hear me announce it.
Maggie links her arm through Lucy's and they go into the brightly lit drawing room. Lucy gives Maggie a conspiratorial smile, then moves away. Stephen is watching and approaches her.
Maggie.
He walks on into the hall. Reluctantly, Maggie follows.
Say you don't hate me. It was wrong what I did. Say you forgive me.
I don't think any evil of you, but please leave me now.
Then why do you say that? Are you angry with me? Do look at me.
She turns to him.
Please go away.
Stephen starts to go, but Lucy appears with Philip.
Now, here's my plan. I think we should all four of us have an outing on the river. We've never done that. Maggie does love boating. Tomorrow?
I hate a large party in a boat.
It cannot be tomorrow. I have to go and visit my Aunt Gritty for a few days.
Oh. Well, directly you return. Four is not so many. Now, we ladies bid you gentlemen good night.
Lucy tucks Maggie's hand in hers and leads her off. Philip and Stephen are left facing each other.
Are you making studies for a painting? I saw you sitting there just now. You didn't appear to be engaged in conversation of any kind.
Well, let's just say I've been studying expression.
Miss Tulliver's, perhaps. Rather a savage one tonight, I think. Rather the fallen princess. I've just been snubbed as usual.
Hypocrite.
Philip glares and limps away, leaving Stephen alone. A white horse canters up towards Dalkut Mill. On it, Tom, who slows the horse as he nears the building and looks thoughtfully round. Inside, he walks through the empty rooms, removing his hat with a sigh. Further along the floss, by Aunt Gritty's cottage, Stephen Guest dismounts from his horse, removes his brown top hat and approaches Aunt Gritty, who's in the garden. He sees Maggie sitting by the front door. Aunt Gritty turns to her niece.
Maggie?
Maggie looks round and sees Stephen. They walk together by the riverbank.
Have you forgiven me? Say you have.
Yes, but you shouldn't have come here.
I've fought it. I've fought it and tried to be true to other claims. Maggie, I love you with my whole soul.
You mustn't say these things. I mustn't hear them. It's no use.
Well, it is of use.
Stephen, there's no end to this misery. Think of Lucy.
I do think of her.
And I have other ties.
You are engaged to Philip Wakeham, isn't that so?
I don't mean to marry anyone else.
Maggie, if you loved me as I love you, we should throw everything else to the winds for the sake of belonging to one another.
I'd rather die than fall into that temptation.
Tell me you don't care for me, then. Tell me you love someone else better. If you do love me, then it's better we marry one another. We can't help the pain we'll cause.
These ties bind us from childhood. Lucy is the dearest person to me.
Ties made in blindness.
These pledges cannot be broken, else there's no fidelity ever in our lives.
But to deny our true feelings is the greater wrong. To pretend is wrong. That will cause them misery too. Surely you must see that.
Love is natural. But so is pity. Pity and faithfulness and memory. These feelings would remain with me and our love would be poisoned. Stephen, please. Don't urge me. Help me. Help me. Because I love you.
Stephen gazes at her with wonder.
One kiss. Before we part, one kiss.
He puts a finger under her chin and, lifting her face to his, kisses her on the lips. Maggie closes her eyes, then rests her forehead against his. Turning suddenly, she walks quickly back towards the cottage, trailing her shawl on the grass behind her. At Lucy's house, Maggie sits in the drawing room, head bowed over a book. She's dressed in a blue travelling cloak. Her mother, Bessie, sees her.
Oh, Maggie.
Lucy asked me to say she's very sorry about the boat trip, but she had to go into town with Mr. Dean. It was something rather urgent, apparently. They set off bright and early.
Bessie goes. Maggie breathes deeply. By the river, Stephen ties up his rowing boat to the landing stage. He's wearing a smart brown frock coat. He stoops to pick up his matching brown hat, smoothing down the glossy silk, then walks up the jetty towards the house. The sun is shining, and there's a spring in his step as he strides eagerly up the path. In the drawing room, Maggie paces nervously. She turns as the French windows open, and Stephen lets himself in. Maggie looks anxious. He smiles.
Lucy not ready yet?
She can't come.
Stephen fingers his hat.
I had a note from Philip. It was delivered round just before I left. He's unwell, and he can't come either.
Unwell? Oh, but we can't. Not just the two of us. We mustn't go.
Stephen saunters across and sits beside her on the couch. He smiles teasingly.
Then we'll stay here.
We can't stay here.
Then we'll go.
Maggie tries to look stern, but her gaze falters.
We shan't be long together.
Seen from underwater, the long, slim shadow of a rowing skiff passes overhead. Bubbles gather round the pointed prow as it smoothly skims out of view. Above the surface, Stephen sits in the centre of the boat, strongly pulling on the oars. Maggie's in the stern, facing him. They row on to where the river broadens into a wide expanse of water. The boat, tiny in the centre, moves steadily on. Maggie is leaning back dreamily, her eyes closed, fine strands of her hair flutter in the breeze. Slowly she opens her eyes and looks lazily around her. Her eyes widen in alarm and she sits forward.
We've come too far.
We have planned nothing. This has happened through the actions of others.
Lucy.
You can't endure other people's anger. Their condemnation. Tom will condemn you if you marry Philip. Philip will condemn you if you marry me. So will Lucy.
We must go back. Turn the boat.
Is that what you want? Is it?
At the Dean's house. Lucy and her father come in through the front door.
Maggie!
Lucy walks into the empty hall.
Did you have a fine time on the river?
Bessie comes swiftly downstairs.
They're not back.
Listen.
What? What's happened? Not an accident.
They've been seen. A lad on the wharf side did see them.
Philip?
Mr. Wakeham couldn't go either. Just Mr. Guest and Maggie. They were seen boarding one of the large boats.
Lucy's eyes widen with horror. A sailing barge with deep red sails is on the river. Huddled on the deck against the cargo, Maggie sits with Stephen. He's sleeping with his lips against her hair. Maggie's face is drawn and anxious. She closes her eyes. There's the shadow of a rowing boat on the water, then Stephen standing on the bank.
We have planned nothing.
Maggie is drifting in the boat.
Lucy, we must go back. Turn the boat.
Philip is watching.
Let's stay together.
We've come too far.
You can't endure other people's anger.
Lucy.
Tom rows Lucy past. On the barge, Maggie and Stephen are both sleeping. Maggie opens her eyes. At the quayside, the barge is unloaded. Stephen helps Maggie off. He pays the bargee, then runs along the quayside to catch up with her. He goes to take Maggie's arm, but she pulls free, then turns to face him.
I'm not going. We must part here.
Maggie.
I've been weak, selfish and hard. I failed Lucy and Philip.
The blow has been struck against them both. If you go back now, you'll achieve nothing. Except strike another blow against me. You cannot do that. Not now.
I've never embraced this. I've let myself drift. Stephen, this has not been my true will.
Good God, what sort of love is this? That you can weigh and balance and change? My love isn't like that.
I would do anything for us to be together.
We can't choose happiness. Not for ourselves or anyone else. We can only choose whether we listen to our conscience.
Stephen shakes his head in despair as Maggie walks away. She climbs the ramp up to the jetty. With a brief smile, he turns to watch her. At the top of the ramp, Maggie pauses and looks back down to where Stephen is standing among the crates and barrels. She walks on and Stephen stands alone. At the mill, the day is overcast. A cart draws up by the bridge. Maggie is perched beside the driver. The cart stops. The driver nods, and she climbs down. The cart moves off. Maggie stands hesitantly, staring at the mill. Bessie comes out, looks round curiously, then sees Maggie. Her face falls. She leads Maggie into the mill house, walking soberly in front. Putting one hand to her forehead, Bessie peers anxiously over her shoulder. Maggie waits in the doorway as Bessie looks through to the far room where Tom sits at a desk working. After a moment, Tom stands and comes through to the main room. Bessie looks at her daughter, then moves away towards the window as Tom enters the main room and sees Maggie. He stands stiffly.
I'm not as guilty as you believe me to be. I never meant to give way to my feelings.
I've had to struggle with my feelings too. I conquered them. And I submitted to all these years of toil because I believed it was my duty to do that. And now you've disgraced us. Disgraced our father's name.
Maggie's face crumples.
I repent it bitterly. I want to make amends.
There can be no amends. You used Philip Wakeham as a screen to deceive Lucy.
I'm here. I've come home.
There is no home for you here. Your behavior, your deception, disgusts me. The very sight of you is hateful.
Bessie looks round as Tom turns on his heel and strides back to his desk. Trembling, Maggie holds out her arms and Bessie runs to her, hugging her close. Philip sits in his father's study, writing by candlelight.
I braced myself to hear of your marriage. I thought of suicide, but I could not lay that black shadow over your joy. Now I see I was wrong. There's something in you stronger than your love for him. I shouldn't have burdened you with my need. I forced words from you, which I now see you felt as chains. I'm still yours, but not with selfish wishes. I've reached another kind of love. I have a faith in you, rather, in which you are free.
Maggie sits reading the letter in her aunt's cottage. Slowly she puts it down. Bessie is at the front door. She has an umbrella and is dressed in bonnet and cloak. Maggie lets her in and kisses her on the cheek.
Oh, Maggie. It hurts me to see you away from the mill, away from your home.
I shan't be here long.
She helps Bessie off with her cloak, seats her in a chair by the fire, then goes to put fresh water in the kettle.
You're all alone here with Gritty and her family away.
Bessie watches her daughter with concern. She opens a small bundle as Maggie puts the kettle back on the hearth.
Where's your cake?
Maggie takes it, then stands awkwardly, holding it.
I must look for work away from here. I must get my own bread. How's Lucy?
She's on the mend, my dear. Never you fret.
Bessie gives a brief smile, and Maggie sits down.
I would so like to see her. I've written her a letter. Would you take it to her?
In the middle of a wood, the rain is teeming down. A huge beech tree stands in a small clearing. A closed carriage appears, pulled by two chestnut horses. It comes to a halt beside the tree. Maggie is standing waiting in the rain. A maid descends from the carriage, opens an umbrella, and helps Lucy out. She stands, watching, as Lucy walks determinedly towards Maggie. Maggie comes to meet her. Lucy gives her a wan smile, and the two women embrace. Maggie looks sober and anxious. She gazes into Lucy's eyes.
He struggled too, Lucy. Forgive him. You will win him back. You are a better person than me. You have surrendered him to me. I could never surrender him to you.
Lucy's bottom lip trembles in her pale, pinched face, and she buries her head against Maggie's shoulder. Releasing herself, she gives Maggie a brave smile, then turns and walks quickly back towards the waiting carriage. The maid shelters her with the umbrella as she climbs back in. Maggie stands, rain streaming down her face.
Get up.
Then steps aside as the carriage pulls away. She stands for a moment, staring after it, a forlorn, grey-cloaked figure. Then turns and hurries off in the opposite direction. At the mill, rain lashes down, stippling the surface of the mill pond. A trickle of water seeps under the door and across the cement floor of the storeroom, soaking into sacks of flour. Outside the offices of Guest & Co., a street lamp casts a faint glow in the filthy night as a figure walks in the rain.
Dearest Maggie, what you have done is beyond my comprehension. You have sacrificed us both to this twisted notion of goodness which you have. People will tell you of schemes afoot to bring me to where Lucy will be on holiday. But even if I drag myself here and there, my soul is still where you left me. Oh, Maggie, just say you want me to come back to you, and I will.
Maggie sits by the fire, looking at words she's written on a sheet of paper. Dear Stephen, yes, come back. Then she lays the sheet of paper on the flames, where it smoulders and burns. Rain drums at the diamond-leaded panes of the small cottage window. Maggie is sleeping in the bed. Water trickles in under the door of her room, then starts to gush, spilling over the flagstones. Maggie sleeps on, unaware, as the water spreads towards the hearth. As the level rises, it seeps over the bricks, extinguishing the flames. Marooned in the bed, Maggie starts to stir, but does not wake. The dirty brown water is a foot deep, and the chest at the foot of Maggie's bed lifts and tips, depositing a vase into the water. The fireside chair begins to float crazily about the room. A table bobs and dips. Maggie moves a little, then opens her eyes. She lifts her head from the pillow and sits up. Quickly, she throws off the coverlet and in her white cotton nightgown steps knee-deep into the water. Pulling aside the bobbing furniture, she wades to the door and tugs at the latch frantically. As the door will not open, she turns back. The water is lapping round her waist. Desperately, she makes her way to the window. She opens the casement and scrambles out over the sill. A rowing boat is bobbing level with the sill. Maggie, her wet nightgown clinging to her legs, hauls herself into the boat and takes up the oar. Using it as a lever, she pushes the boat off, then sits properly, placing both oars in the rowlocks and starts to row. The rain streams down in torrents, plastering her hair to her face, churning up the dark surface of the River Floss, which has spread in all directions. Maggie shrinks to a tiny figure as she pulls away into the foul night. Morning. Seen from above, blue sky and clouds reflect on the surface of the floodwaters that are now calm as a mill pond. Maggie rows on, past the green leafy tops of bushes, half submerged. The rowing boat leaves a trail of widening ripples in its wake. The mill comes into view, a massive brick island sticking up out of the water. Maggie turns to gaze at it, rowing steadily closer. From the mill itself, framed in one small pane of a high window, first the shadow of the boat, then the boat itself, the oars dipping rhythmically, and Maggie rowing strongly. Tom pushes the window open and leans out. Maggie stands in the boat and turns to look up at him. Tom looks down at her and smiles.
Magsie.
Maggie smiles back.
I prayed you'd come.
Her smile widens. Then she frowns.
Is Mother safe?
She's visiting Lucy.
Maggie nods, then points to the overhanging gantry high up on the side of the building.
Come down on the hoist.
She lets her arm drop. Tom grins and nods. He shuts the window as Maggie sits back down in the boat and takes up the oars. In the gantry, by the overhanging hoist, Tom ties a rope round a beam and fastens it. Then he kneels down and opens the trapdoor, looking through it down to the floodwater far below. Maggie rows the boat round, directly beneath him, and ships the oars. She looks up, and Tom, high above her, lets the free end of the rope drop to the water. Then, carefully, he starts to lower himself through the hatch and inches his way down the rope. But the secured end comes undone. The rope unravels. Tom, still clinging to it, plunges down into the water. He claws his way to the surface, but the rope twines itself round his body. Maggie dives into the murky green water and swims towards him, her hair streaming out behind her. Frantically, she tugs at the rope, now coiling around Tom's neck. Bubbles stream from his mouth as Maggie pulls at the rope desperately. Tom looks at her for a moment, then starts to drop like a stone. Maggie clutches at Tom's hands. His eyes stare blankly, his hair rippling like weed, his fingers clenched around her own. Then their hands part, and Maggie starts to sink down herself. A shaft of sunlight pierces the depths. Jumbled reflections of clouds and sky and the shadow of the boat ripple and fragment above them as brother and sister drift steadily down. Arms outstretched, eyes staring, clothes billowing. Maggie and Tom face each other, sinking deeper and deeper. The shadow of the rowing boat rocks gently overhead. Seen through a mist, young Maggie and young Tom are sitting together on the low branch of a leafy tree. The mist clears as solemnly Maggie leans forward and kisses Tom gently on the cheek. Tom looks at her and gives a small smile. He reaches out and takes her hand. Then he jumps down from the branch, turns, and reaching up, puts his hands round Maggie's waist and helps her to the ground. Hand in hand, they run across the rough green grass towards Dalkett Mill. The small figures turn to shadow and disappear. Maggie Tulliver, Emily Watson. Bessie Tulliver, Cheryl Campbell. Philip Wakeham, James Frayne. Edward Tulliver, Bernard Hill. Sophie Dean, Joanna David. Lawyer Wakeham, Nicholas Gex. Aunt Gritty, Sheena Govan. The Reverend Stelling, Peter Gunn. Mr. Glegg, Will Knightley. Tom Tulliver, Ivan Meredith. Mr. Dean, Paul Ridley. Jane Glegg, Jessica Turner. Stephen Guest, James Webber Brown. Lucy Dean, Lucy Wybrow. Young Maggie, Lucy Borton. Young Tom, John Lee. Young Lucy, Dominique Belcour. Young Philip, Stefan Vetswavik. Mr. Riley, Roger Booth. Mr. Poulter, Peter Russell. Luke, Andrew Granger. Keziah, Linda Armstrong. The executive producer was David M. Thompson. Production designer, Adrian Smith. Director of photography, David Johnson. Costume designer, Jill Taylor. Casting, Annie Henderson. Editor, Alan Jones. The music was composed and conducted by John Scott and performed by the BBC Concert Orchestra. The associate producer was Laura Julian. The Mill on the Floss was a Carnival Films production for the BBC, 1997. The audio description was written by Louise Fryer, read by Patience Tomlinson, and the description engineer was Steve Hudson.